Friends of WLRN as the beneficiary of your estate or a portion of it, providing an enduring legacy of public media for years to come. To learn more about making an impact through planned gifts, call 305-350-7977.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, today we visit with longtime CIA and State Department analyst Melvin Goodman. He's the author of the book National Security, The Cost of American Militarism. He's also an adjunct professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. Melvin Goodman joins us from Bethesda, Maryland. Welcome to you, Professor.
Thank you, Joe. Good to be with you.
Hi, Professor. I just want to say the name of the book The name of the book is National Insecurity.
Oh, that.
Yes.
There's a big difference, isn't there?
Yes, there is. Professor, tell us more specifically about your four-decade background in the intelligence community and the U.S. Army, and when and why you became a critic of both.
Well, I left graduate school in 1966 and joined the CIA. I thought it would be a short-term proposition, but frankly, I was fascinated by the work in the field of intelligence. I was a Soviet studies major, getting my doctorate in Russian studies and American diplomatic history. So it was a good fix. But in the 1980s, the CIA received a very ideological director, William Casey, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan. Casey was a Cold War demagogue, had a very hard line on any issue involving the Soviet Union or China, for that matter, and he appointed a hardline deputy, Robert M. Gates, who went on to become Secretary of Defense for both George W. Bush and, quite surprisingly, for Barack Obama. And in the 1980s, you had terrible politicization of intelligence. So whereas several of us could see the weakness of the Soviet Union, we didn't predict the total demise of the Soviet Union, but we could see that the Soviet Union was capitulating to the United States and wanted arms control and was essentially suing for peace. You couldn't get this intelligence line out of the building because Casey and Gates were filters for the Reagan administration, which had a hard ideological line on anything to do with Moscow. So in 1986, I left the CIA and went to the National War College to teach. I was a professor of international relations, but then in 2003, I think the worst decision ever made on national security was made by President Bush to go to war in Iraq based on intelligence lies. Once again, the CIA was corrupting its intelligence. So I decided it was time to leave the National War College as well. And since that time, I've been affiliated with the Center for International Policy. I run their national security program.
Do you blame the CIA for the intelligence failure in Iraq?
I blame them for the intelligence failure, but not for the decision to go to war. You know, if you look at the memoirs, as I have in preparing the book, National Insecurity, I read the memoirs of Bush and Cheney and Condi Rice and Donald Rumsfeld. And all of them, without exception, blame intelligence from the CIA. Well, that is just nonsense. They were in part responsible for the terrible intelligence produced by the CIA. Now, I blame the CIA for totally corrupting the product and pandering to the White House. But George Bush and Dick Cheney had made up their minds to go to war against Iraq, and frankly, the intelligence had nothing to do with it. So I would blame the CIA for corrupting the intelligence. I would blame Bush and Cheney for corrupting the entire public policy. And I think some blame should go to the Congress for not taking any of these issues seriously and not monitoring a terrible national intelligence estimate that was done by the CIA in October 2002 that essentially made the case that the president wanted to go to war. And if you want to spread the blame around, I would throw in the mainstream media, including the Washington Post particularly, but also the New York Times, for buying into the government's line on weapons of mass destruction, which was a total fraud. And several of us did our best to inform the journalist community. And actually, I think a reporter who may be in Miami, Jonathan Landay, does that name ring a bell?
Not to me.
Clatchy Papers. At that time, Landy,
of course, they own the Herald.
2003 was with the Philadelphia newspaper. And I remember getting in touch with both Landy and his partner, Warren Strobel, to say that the government's case for weapons of mass destruction was a total fraud. Messages we also delivered, by the way, to the Washington Post and the New York Times, but unlike the others, Landy and Strobel actually ran with this story and eventually, I think, received some prizes for their coverage on the run-up to the Iraq War, the war itself.
So what do you think was the real reason behind the beginning of the Iraq War?
I think, and frankly, you can't, there are no documents to prove this, and the sad thing about reading these memoirs from all of the major players is they don't provide any clues whatsoever about what they were really thinking. But in studying Cheney's career, as I have, going back to the 1970s, when he and Donald Rumsfeld were working for Gerald Ford, as one was the Secretary of Defense, the other was the Chief of Staff in the White House, I think Cheney was obsessed with the notion of creating a more powerful presidency. Cheney had been one of those supporters of the Vietnam War who felt we should have pursued the war to the end, who felt that the Congress had weakened the role of the presidency during the war, and Cheney had committed himself, as had Rumsfeld, to improving the power of the presidency. And the best way to do that, of course, is to create a wartime president. So Cheney, who in 1991, he was Secretary of Defense during Desert Storm, was not in favor of expanding the war to Iraq. In 2001 and 2002, wanted to go to a war against Iraq. And I guess I hesitate to indulge this Freudian notion with regard to President Bush, but I think he was trying to prove to his father that the son could do what the father couldn't do, which was to get Saddam Hussein, and also do what the father couldn't do, which is to get reelected, which George W. Bush managed to do. I don't think oil had anything to do with these decisions. I don't think Israel, a lot of people say it was the Israeli lobby that convinced the Bush administration to go to war. That's just total nonsense. I think there were domestic reasons. I think they did know that there were no nuclear weapons in Iraq. And frankly, I talked to Paul Wolfowitz, who was the Undersecretary for Defense under Rumsfeld, and I said, how did you come up with the nuclear notion? You know, the smoking gun should not be a mushroom cloud. And he said very candidly that this is the only thing we could all agree on and the only thing that we thought the American people would buy into. So that's exactly the phony argument that was put together, and it was sold to the press, to the Congress, to the United Nations. Secretary of State Colin Powell went to the UN in February of 2003 to give his phony speech on why we needed to go to war. So that sad chapter deals with total misuse of intelligence, total unconscionable policies on the part of our leaders. It's a very sad period in American history.
In your book, Professor, you suggest that the Pentagon has now stolen the priorities of the CIA. How?
Well, the Pentagon has had help in this, and they had help from George Bush, and now they've had some help from Barack Obama, which is to militarize the CIA. When Harry Truman created the CIA in 1947, he created it to counter the poor intelligence that came out of the Pentagon. The Pentagon basically engages in worst-case intelligence. No matter what the scenario is, they will draw up the worst case and say there's intelligence to support that. And they do that to justify their budgets, their bloated defense budgets. President Eisenhower understood this. Our more recent presidents either didn't care or haven't even understood it. I don't think Bill Clinton completely understood it. I don't think Barack Obama has completely understood it. So George W. Bush bragged about the fact that there was a marriage. That was his word, a marriage between the Pentagon and the CIA. Well, there should not be a marriage between the Pentagon and the CIA. These are institutions that are, in many ways, rival institutions. The intelligence of the CIA should be a check on the exaggerated perceptions that come out of the Pentagon. And both Bush and Obama contributed to this problem by naming four-star generals to be directors of the CIA, which was outrageous. Michael Hayden, in the case of George Bush, even though he was the director of the National Security Agency, when the warrantless eavesdropping started without any legal justification or framework whatsoever, but it never came up in his confirmation hearings for a CIA, which shows you what a poor job the Senate Intelligence Committee committee is capable of. And then Obama went one step further when he appointed General David Petraeus to be a CIA director, which was particularly outrageous because Petraeus had such strong policy views on very sensitive intelligence matters. So he had very initially had a great deal of problems within the CIA because he was pressing his very strong political views and overlooking the intelligence material that often countered his policy views. So Bush and Obama both have made serious mistakes in this area of militarization. And one of the things that needs to be done is to demilitarize national security, demilitarize foreign policy, and demilitarize the intelligence community, and particularly the CIA.
But is it important that the U.S. military supremacy reign?
Well, you know, you can say military supremacy, and I guess no one is going to argue with that, but the debate should be over what is supremacy. We've gone way beyond supremacy in the nuclear field, in the naval field, in the Air Force. You know, you can argue, yes, we probably should have an edge in all of these areas, but how much of an edge is really necessary? And when you overbuild, to go back again to President Eisenhower, my first chapter in the book deals with President Eisenhower and his four very important warnings, and one of the warnings he gave in what he called the Cross of Iron speech is that if you overbuild on the military, which we have done, then you will not have money to rebuild infrastructure, to rebuild bridges and roads, have the kind of educational system you need to do all of the domestic things that need to be done. And that's exactly where we are now because of the overspending since 9/11 particularly, but also in the 1980s by Ronald Reagan when it was totally unnecessary because the Soviet Union was coming apart at the seams. So it's a very easy thing to say, yes, we need to have supremacy in the military field, but we're spending more money on the military than the entire world combined. And the military budget you read about is only half of what it actually is because people who quote it in, the mainstream media never talk about the Department of Energy, which is where the nuclear funding is, or the Veterans Administration, which has rising disability claims from these various wars. We haven't even hit the peak in disability from Vietnam and Desert Storm, let alone the contemporary wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Then if you look at the intelligence community, there's $80 billion right there, and that's become a paramilitary organization.
We're speaking with Melvin.
They're doing the bidding of the military.
Oh, excuse me. We need to take a short break. We're speaking with Melvin Goodman. He's currently director of the National Security Project at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C., and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. The name of his book, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. We'll take that break. We'll come back and open our phones and take some emails. Stay with us.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
We are the hosts of NPR's new program, Here and Now, coming in July.
It's a news magazine that will keep you up to date with the day's news that breaks in between Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
And introduce you to people doing amazing things far from the headlines.
It's Here and Now with Jeremy Hobson, that's me.
And Robin Young.
That's her.
Monday through Thursday at 2 p.m., starting July 1st, here on South Florida's NPR news station, 91.3 WLRN.
You can earn an accredited MBA from Florida Atlantic University. FAU offers a professional MBA on weeknights and an executive MBA on weekends. Programs that start in August include individual leadership assessment and executive coaching, an international trip option, and VIP service. GMAT is waived for qualifying students. Information sessions and more available online at faumba.com. That's faumba.com.
You can find Topical Currents on Facebook, a dedicated page with daily program descriptions, links to our guests, authors, and books. Facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper, and we're visiting with Melvin Goodman. He's written National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. Professor, you just mentioned President Eisenhower and his warnings, so let's listen to his one of them from January 17th, 1961.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed 4 major wars among great nations. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
So, Professor, President Eisenhower was a military man to his core. He led the forces. What would cause him to issue such a warning?
Wow. Well, my first reaction is thank you so much for playing that. I wish every station in the country would play that once a month. I wish the President of the United States would read it every now and then. His concern was on several levels, and it dealt, for the most part, with the idea of permanent war and a permanent arms industry that would have tremendous political and economic power. Permanent war, of course, is where we are now. We are still operating under the authorization to use force from 9/11. It was passed just several weeks after 9/11, and it's what Barack Obama says he needs to repeal. But Eisenhower's concern was not only in the military area per se, but in the economic area and in the area of civil liberties. His concern was with permanent war, you will not have the resources you need to do what we need to do domestically, which again is where we are now, and also with permanent war and a permanent arms industry with great political power, you will start to compromise civil liberties and personal liberties. And when you think of the current situation today involving Edward Snowden and his revelations about the culture of secrecy and the vast bureaucratic power that's been thrown out of collecting secrets from the American people in terms of their own communications and their own activities, this is what concerned Eisenhower in 1961 in terms of giving this farewell address that most of it was written by him personally.
A lot of people would really disagree with you, Professor,
on
the Snowden
business. I was attending Johns Hopkins in 1961, and his brother, of course, Milton Eisenhower, used to go back and forth to the White House on a regular basis to consult with his brother, the president. So it was an important speech given for very important reasons, and it couldn't be more applicable to the current situation.
A lot of people would disagree with you on the Snowden business, Professor, thinking
that
he took things in his own hands and was dealing with some very important topics, that he necessarily shouldn't have been making that decision, necessarily.
No, I understand that. But my problem is whistleblowers are an extremely important commodity in a democracy. And one of the reasons why people take such extreme actions, as, say, a Bradley Manning, who's facing trial now, 3 years after his arrest, or Edward Snowden, who eventually will be facing trial in this country, I think that's kind of predictable, is that the institutions for whistleblowing have really been compromised. So it's very difficult to find a genuine inspector general in an agency that you can take an impropriety to. It's very difficult to go to the congressional intelligence committees because they've become really protectors of government policy and are totally resistant to the efforts of whistleblowers and contrarians. The mainstream media really follows a very corporate line with regard to the government, and the court won't hear cases in national security because they say state secrets are involved. So I'm not defending what Snowden did, and I certainly wouldn't have gone about it in the way he did it, but as someone who was a whistleblower in 1991 when I testified before Congress against the confirmation of Robert Gates, I think you have to look at the conditions that exist in our polity at this current time and what his motives were. I think there's a tendency on the part of the media, again, to ridicule and marginalize people who take the steps that they take. You know, Bradley Manning was ridiculed and marginalized for being a cross-dresser. I've read a lot about the fact that Edward Snowden has a girlfriend who's a pole dancer in Hawaii. I've seen very little speculation on why Snowden did what he did or why Manning did what he did. And they've really unearthed very important issues that deal with topics that need to be debated in this country that we just don't hear enough discussion about.
You mentioned you were a whistleblower in 1991, and you testified against, who did you say, Robert Gates? Tell us about that.
Well, I think I mentioned earlier that I left the CIA in 1986 because of the politicization of intelligence.
Right.
The politicization was carried out by the director, William Casey, and his deputy director, Robert Gates. First, he was deputy director for intelligence, and then he was deputy director of the entire CIA. They were politicizing intelligence. They were spinning intelligence. So in 1991, when George H.W. Bush nominated Gates to be CIA director, I went to the Senate Intelligence Committee at some risk, I must say, because I was teaching at the National War College then. In other words, I was an employee of the Department of Defense, and throwing myself in front of a moving train, which in this case was the White House nomination for CIA director. But I felt conscience demanded that I tell my story of politicization. And it was somewhat effective in the way it was told, because there were more votes against Robert Gates than all of the other CIA directors in history, going back to 1947. 31 or 33 senators voted against Gates because they believed the accusations with regard to politicization. In fact, I wrote a book about this called The Failure of Intelligence that deals with this whole problem of politicization, which is really the key to having an intelligence organization. Once you politicize intelligence, you really have no need for an intelligence organization. They serve no function whatsoever. This is really the holy grail of the whole business, which is what the late Senator Daniel Moynihan contended. Whistleblowing is extremely important. We shouldn't jump to conclusions about who these people are and why they did it. We did that with regard to Daniel Ellsberg when the Pentagon Papers were released, and he was accused of treason, as I recall. What he did was to expose all the lies of the Johnson administration that got us into a totally unnecessary war that was unwinnable. Where were the current whistleblowers with regard to torture and abuse or the secret prisons or extraordinary renditions, which were a violation of various Geneva conventions against kidnapping people and turning them over to foreign governments, such as Syria, by the way, that practice torture and abuse.
How about John Brennan?
So, I was opposed to John Brennan as a CIA director because I guess I know too much about John Brennan. I know how he rose to the top. He's always been a company man. So I opposed him when Obama tried to nominate him in 2009 in his first term. And I opposed him more recently when he finally did go ahead and nominate him and he was confirmed. And I don't think he's tough enough to tell the president things that the president may not want to hear. And that's the key to being a successful director of Central Intelligence Agency. You have to be able to tell the whole story with the bark on. And John Brennan never had a record for that when I knew him at the CIA. And also, when you look at his very active role on the drone program, it was Brennan who widened the arena for the CIA's conduct of drones to where we're at a situation where the President of the United States really picks the personal targets of these drones that fire Hellfire missiles. And now we've developed a drone policy in which we call targeted killings or signature killings, where we're killing people whose names we don't even know, but their activities conform to a certain pattern. They ride around in SUVs that we identify with terrorist organization, or they go to locations, whether they're commercial locations or residential locations that we identify with terrorism or insurgency. But we may not know the individuals, or we may not know who's in the car when we target the car. That's how the son of Al-Awlaki was killed, the teenager, an American citizen, which was an outrage. So for those reasons, I was not in favor of the John Brennan nomination.
We're speaking with Melvin Goodman. He's written National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. We'll take a short break. We'll come back. We will take your calls and emails.
This is 91.3 WLRN, and that's NPR for South Florida, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. I'm Caroline Brader-Watts. Light rain currently falling in Miami. The temperature is 86 degrees, and we'll return to the program in just a moment.
Starting July 7th, every Sunday at 11 a.m., Snap Judgment from NPR means your mother, your kids, the dog, and your boss are just going to have to wait until after the story is over. My name is Glenn Washington, and Snap Judgment is storytelling with a beat. Don't miss it right here, 91.3 WLRN.
The Coral Gables Congregational United Church of Christ Community Arts Program Summer Concert Series continues 8 p.m. Thursday, June 27th with pianist Orly Shaham in a program of Chopin, Brahms, and Mussorgsky. The London Guardian hails her as perfection. The series also brings Pepe Romero, the Brubeck Brothers Quartet, the Alan Balog Jazz Orchestra, and John Pizzarelli. Tickets and info, including masterclasses, at 305-448-7421 and communityartsprogram.org.
And it's the Monday edition, Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Professor Melvin Goodman. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, you can email us, radio@WLRN.org, or you can tweet, that's at Topical Currents. First caller, this is from Fort Lauderdale. This is JR. Hi. Go ahead, you're on the air. JR. I guess he's not ready.
JR? Okay, Professor. Well, you criticize every Secretary of State over the last 20 years, beginning with James Baker. So what has happened to the Department of State, and how do you feel about John Kerry?
Well, let me make one thing clear. I've criticized every Secretary of State since James Baker.
Oh, okay.
Not to include James Baker.
Okay.
James Baker, to me, was the last effective Secretary of State that we've had. In fact, George Shultz and James Baker in the years from the mid-1980s to 1992 were extremely effective stewards of American foreign policy at the State Department. Since then, it's been incredibly mediocre in terms of the leadership we've had. Now with John Kerry, Obama has appointed person who, to me, is cut from the same cloth as George Shultz and James Baker. I think he's tough-minded, he's pragmatic, he's well-schooled, he's trained for this position of Secretary of State. I think it's a natural position for someone, given his career and particularly his service as chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So I have high hopes for John Kerry, particularly in the wake of Hillary Clinton, for which I can find no accomplishment whatsoever in her 4 years as Secretary of State. My concern, though, is that Barack Obama's White House is extremely jealous of its priorities and its power and its prerogatives, and it's very difficult for anyone outside the White House to have any real influence on the administration. So Kerry is going to have to find a way to exploit his personal relationship with the president, which he's had over the years, which was very good during the short period Obama served in the Senate, in order to energize the role of diplomacy in foreign policy. We have really shot ourselves in the foot in many ways because governments that we have problems with, we don't recognize when these are the very governments that we should have diplomatic relations with, we should have embassies, we should have ambassadors. And of course, at the top of the list, I would put Iran, I would put North Korea. It's ridiculous to practice a policy of non-recognition of those governments. We need to be talking to them on a regular basis. They have nuclear programs that concern us. Non-recognition is totally counterproductive.
But
I would add to that list with Cuba. You know, it's way past time to conduct an exchange of relations with Cuba. This has been going on since 1959. We're the only country in the Western Hemisphere that pretends Cuba doesn't exist. And this is a ridiculous posture, this ostrich-like posture that we don't recognize that Cuba has a diplomatic or governance existence.
Let's take another call. Richard in Sunrise, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I'm good, Professor Goodman, that you're writing this book. I wanted to ask you a question. A journalist I heard about 2 years ago, and I have a good memory, and he said that when they took Cheney to the bunker, he said that they were amazed at his composure, that he wasn't glued to the TV set like they were watching the events that were going on with the World Trade Tower, 9/11, that he was at his desk writing how to expand the presidential power for the executive branch. To me, that's suspect, because I was trying to figure out how to get my kids out of the school, because when they bombed the Ben and then they went to the Pentagon and they bombed the Pentagon, I was thinking defense mode. So, and the other thing I wanted to ask you, did you also put in there how overwhelming the American public was against going to war? They were writing, I mean, they were calling in 10-1 almost at the time to their Senate, and I called other Senate offices besides my own Florida offices to confirm that, and they said, yeah, it's overwhelming. The American people do not want to go to war, because we remember Vietnam. I want to know if you covered those two things in the books. And one more thing about whistleblowers. They were reaching halfway around the world to get this 27-year-old guy that blew the whistle on him. What about the guys in the White House that outed Valerie Plame and probably was responsible for the death of people overseas that were dealing with her? Those are the three questions, and I'll just listen to it off the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think the American people, for the most part, supported the war in Iraq, and certainly the Congress did.
Well, let me deal with that point first. I frankly think the American people were sound asleep. Remember, Vietnam brought out a very impressive peace movement in this country, and I attended most of those anti-war demonstrations, even though I was working at the CIA at the time. They were out in considerable number. They were vociferous. They were writing letters. They were calling their congressmen. They were active. They put tremendous pressure on the White House, so much pressure that Nixon finally had to say, okay, I'm going to abolish the draft if you will get off the streets to protect your sons and grandsons from being called up to war. And that deal worked. That Faustian bargain was successful. And as a result, there was no anti-war movement against Iraq. I really don't know what your caller is talking about, because I've talked to staffers on the Hill, and they say they rarely get calls from constituents on foreign policy and national security matters, so it's sort of a free vote for them. They don't have to vote their conscience. They can vote any way that the White House wants them to vote, because they feel constituents don't care. So constituents, as I see it, citizens, as I see it, have been AWOL in this country. Now, on the question of Cheney, I find the caller's observations very interesting and quite consistent with my view that his interest in the war was expanding the power of the presidency, and his first reaction to 9/11 was, now we have an incident that can become the pretext for expanding those powers, even illegal powers like warrantless eavesdropping.
But no one can really be sure what happened in that bunker. That's hearsay, what the caller
said. No, I don't think we have. As I said before, when I gave my reasons, I said I don't have any documents to prove what I'm saying. All I can do is give you my study and my reading and the people that I've talked to. But I find that anecdote is quite interesting because it is very consistent with the view that Cheney wanted to increase the power of the presidency, and there's no better way to do that than by going to war. You know, 9/11 was a pretext for that war. That Bush administration was going to go to war against Iraq. 9/11 gave them a very convenient excuse to do so, even though Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11, nothing to do with al-Qaeda, nothing to do with Osama bin Laden.
Do you believe 9/11?
Final point with regard to Snowden as a whistleblower. Yeah, it's interesting to bring up the case of Valerie Plame, who I know very well. She was a clandestine agent undercover at the CIA, and therefore her identity and affiliation was protected by law, by the Foreign Intelligence Identities Act from 1982-1983. Cheney obviously violated that law when his aide, Scooter Libby, outed Valerie Plame. And there's no basis for assuming that Scooter Libby did this on his own. He was just an apparatchik for Dick Cheney. So Dick Cheney had to be behind this. But the only consequences were to a sentence that should have sent Libby to jail for a couple of years, but President Bush commuted the sentence. He didn't pardon Libby, which is what Dick Cheney wanted him to do, and because of that disagreement over Scooter Libby, Bush and Cheney really hardly ever spoke to each other the last year of the Bush presidency. There was a serious falling out between the two men, and it was in part over the failure to pardon Scooter Libby.
I'd just like to go back for a moment when you talked about the lack of diplomacy with countries like North Korea, Iran. In 2008, President Obama said he wanted to speak with leaders throughout the international community and was condemned for it.
Well, he was condemned for it during the campaign by someone who was running against him. Hillary Clinton called him very naive. I thought he was spot on. He said, we have to talk to anyone, whether it's Ahmadinejad or at that time Kim Jong-il. These are the people we need to talk to. Talking to our allies doesn't really help our cause, except in certain specific situations. It's people where we have differences that we need to have a running dialogue. My disappointment with Obama has been his failure to follow up on that and to pursue aggressive diplomacy with regard to these countries. You know, North Korea last week, even though it was buried on the inside pages of the major newspapers, including the New York Times and the Washington Post, North Korea says it wants a dialogue with the United States. Well, why wouldn't we accept an initiative like that? We have nothing to lose. You know, North Korea has no military power whatsoever. They can engage in all sorts of saber rattling, which they did. And now it looks like the saber rattling was done in order to set up a possible initiative to start a dialogue with the United States, but we've ignored them. And I would say the same thing for Iran. Iran has just had a very interesting election, much different from the elections in 2008, 2009, which were apparently totally corrupt. No one's saying this wasn't a fair and free election, and over 70% of the people in Iran voted, which is not a number that we can claim for our elections in this country. And lo and behold, they elected the most moderate candidate who was running, who had more than 50% of the vote. He was running against five other or six other people. The next largest vote getter had about 17 or 18% of the vote. So this was a huge one-sided election, with the winner being someone who wants to moderate their international position. He's made that clear. Well, that calls for an initiative, I would think, from the United States, again, with nothing to lose. And finally, with regard to Cuba, frankly, I thought when Chavez died, the leader in Venezuela, that was a perfect opportunity to shock the entire Western Hemisphere by announcing that we are willing to exchange diplomatic relations with Cuba. Non-recognition serves no interest whatsoever. It may feel good from a moral standpoint to act in this way, but in terms of American national interests and American strategy and American position around the world, it's totally unhelpful.
We're speaking with Melvin Goodman. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins University of Government and the director of the National Security Project at the Center for International Policy in Washington. One more short break, and we'll be right back.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. City Year Miami unites a diverse group of 17 to 24-year-olds for a year of service as tutors, mentors, and role models who make a difference to students and schools. You can learn more online at cityyear.org. City Year, give a year, change the world.
With fuel prices climbing, you may be rethinking driving that gas guzzler you have. We have the answer. Donate it to the WLRN Vehicle Donation Program. It's easy. Just call 877-WLRN-CAR or go online to WLRN.org. Once we have all of your information, we'll make arrangements to pick up your vehicle. After it's sold, we'll send you all of the paperwork. Put that gas guzzler to work for WLRN. Donate it at 877-957-6227 or online at WLRN.org.
I like to dress them up, put on their makeup, fix their hair, go to a movie, go sit at a restaurant, watch a show, do something. At that age, they need to go out, do for themselves, and feel like they're still living. My name is Carlene Thompson. I'm a home health aide. I take care of elderly person. I like to make them feel like they're still 16. That's what I do. You're listening to WLRN 91.3.
And it's the Monday edition of Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Professor Melvin Goodman. Bonnie, you said you have an emailer?
Yes. Do our overseas bases serve our country's interests or those of the host country and the defense industry?
Well, the main interests that are served are the military-industrial complex, and particularly the huge defense oligarchs, these huge companies, five or six major companies that sell weapons overseas. And again, you have to ask the question, why is it that 70 years after the end of World War II, why do we have so many huge bases in Germany and Italy, for example? Where are the threats to Germany and Italy? What is the purpose of these bases? And frankly, when you look at Asia, why do we have as many troops as we do, the 40,000 troops in South Korea? I think South Korea is in a position to defend itself. We've provided great assistance to South Korea over the years. They developed a very strong government, certainly much stronger than North Korea across the demilitarized zone. And you could say the same thing about Japan. I think Japan is in a position to basically take care of its own interests with the possible exception of a serious confrontation with China. But it's hard to imagine China engaging in that kind of confrontation with Japan. It wouldn't serve Chinese national interests. We're the only country that has bases all over the world. No other country does it. We have 11 aircraft carriers and carrier task forces, which cost tens of billions of dollars a year. Why do we need 11? How did that number come to be? Why is it sacrosanct? Can't anything be done about it? And then when you look at military aid, everyone talks about foreign aid, which is a very insignificant amount of money, but military aid is a significant amount of money. And when you look at the largest recipients of military aid, what do we get for that money? What do we get for the military aid we give to Israel? Israel doesn't need our military aid. Israel can defend itself and has the economy to take care of itself. Military aid to Pakistan? Pakistan is hardly an ally. Pakistan is allied with the Taliban that we're trying to defeat in Afghanistan. And why the military aid to Egypt that we give them? Military aid to Turkey? Military aid to Iraq. we have really little business to do with Iraq. Iraq is now lined up in a certain way with Iran, which is a strategic situation we've created by going to war the way we did against Saddam Hussein.
Let's go back and take a...
Our military position has to be questioned, and so does the military aid position.
Let's take a phone call or two. This is Dave in Miami. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to ask the professor if he could elaborate on what exactly is the politicization of intelligence. And also, he just commented on Iraq. My take is that we got Saddam Hussein out of power, and now we have Iran as an even bigger threat to deal with. And well, I would just like to know what his ideas are on that subject, and I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, two good points. On politicization, politicization of intelligence is any time you slant the intelligence or tailor the intelligence to adhere to a political line. So, in other words, when the White House wanted intelligence to support going to war against Iraq, what the CIA did was to create out of whole cloth, in many cases, the argument that Iraq may have had weapons of mass destruction, even though there was no evidence for that whatsoever. And the same thing in the 1980s, which was my reason for leaving the CIA, Ronald Reagan wanted to increase defense spending. These were the greatest increases in peacetime in defense spending. And to justify that, he had to show that the Soviet Union was 10 feet tall and a serious threat. So Bill Casey and Bob Gates went along with this by politicizing the intelligence on the Soviet Union. So that's what I mean about politicization. It's slanting, tailoring, cooking the books, cherry-picking. There are all sorts of terms that are thrown at the problem. His remarks about Iran and Iraq are spot on. You know, from a strategic standpoint, it served American interests in the 1980s and 1990s to have an Iraq that was at odds with Iran. Iran is really the most important regional player in the Persian Gulf. We haven't had good relations with Iran since the Khomeini Revolution in 1979. So what you're trying to do is contain the power of Iran. That's our strategic goal in the Persian Gulf in order to protect the oil lines of communication. By going to war against Iraq, the net strategic result has been an Iraq that now has improved relations with Iran. One of the ways Iran gets its military supplies to the Syrian government is to go through Iraq. They overfly Iraq, and we can't seem to get Baghdad to stop that. And they transport equipment through Iraq on their way to not only Syria, but Hezbollah, the important organization in Lebanon, which is supporting the Assad government.
What do you think we should...
having these two countries in alignment, this hurts our overall strategic position. This is the major reason why that war was such a strategic nightmare and so strategically stupid.
We're very short on time, by the way.
But I'd like to know what you think we should be doing in Syria.
Well, I thought 2 years ago we should have conducted a no-fly zone and gotten more active in support of the opposition. The problem is that Obama has sort of dithered and dallied so long that now the opposition is widely divided, and fundamentalists are a major part of that opposition, and Assad has gained the upper hand, so I don't know what impact we can have. So the small amounts of aid we've just announced, I think, are kind of feckless in terms of a policy in Syria. So I have no idea what the Obama administration's mission really is in Syria.
Is there a website where people could learn more about you and the book?
Yes, CIPonline.org. CIP is the Center for International Policy. It's the organization where I work. I run the National Security Department of the Center. So CIPonline.org. There's a national security template, and it has all my writings, including my recent writings on whistleblowers and on the political nature of these national security debates that are so important right now.
Well, we have to run, Professor.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to
talk
about these very important
issues. Melvin
Goodman
is the author of National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that wraps up our program. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Thanks also to Michael Stock. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. Also, more information and book links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is an At Your Service edition with employment attorney Donna Ballman. Of course, we'll be taking your calls. And calendar time. On this day in 1950, 63 years ago, the first German V-2 rocket is launched from Cape Canaveral, starting the early missile program under Werner von Braun. Also on this day in 1953, 60 years ago, Massachusetts Senator John F. Kennedy announces his engagement to Jacqueline Lee Bouvier. The nuptials occurred in September at Newport, Rhode Island. And one more while we fondly remember the Royal Order of Raccoons. On this day in 1987, 26 years ago, the death of bigger-than-life comic Jackie Gleason in Lauderhill, Florida. Orson Welles was the one who termed him the Great One. Jackie Gleason was almost Archie Bunker. In the first sketch of The Honeymooners, Art Carney's Norton character was a cop, not a sewer worker. So we close with lines from The Honeymooners, an exchange between Ralph and wife Alice. Ralph says, "You have just made fun of something that's very big, that's close to my heart." Alice says, "Ralph, the only thing big that's close to your heart is your stomach." This is Joseph Cooper. Or Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This is 91.